You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Today's broadcast is in memory of Cynthia Dove Morrison. Here's the continuation of Queen Mom by Julie Miller. Wong explores this modern romantic dynamic in Always Be My Maybe, which she co-wrote with Park and Michael Golamko. She plays the successful partner in the will-they-won't-they relationship, a celebrity chef who, while sometimes isolated by the trappings of her career, is allowed to be both ambitious and vulnerable. Wong chose to play a chef based on Nikki Nakayama, the only woman featured in the first season of Netflix's Chef's Table, because it provided a close analog to the life of a female comedian. The restaurant industry, like comedy, is a very male-dominated profession, she says. The hours are at night, you're always working on weekends, so you can never go to, like, baby showers or weddings. And in terms of voice, her job as a chef is so much about constantly innovating and having a unique point of view. But at the same time, none of that matters if the food doesn't taste good, and none of that matters if the jokes aren't funny. The movie was directed by Khan, who is excited for audiences to see a new, softer side to her friend. I think people will come into this movie expecting her to be funny, but then she shows, in my opinion, such a range of emotion as an actress. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people. I was blown away by her. As for Park's character, the Harry to Wong's Sally 2.0, he's a little lost. A 30-something male, still living and working with his dad in San Francisco, driving the same car he did in high school, and spending nights playing with his longtime band. It wasn't about purposefully flipping gender roles, but realistically representing many men's 30s, including Park's, and not in a way that makes the period seem shameful. Sometimes I feel like in movies, when guys live with their parents, it's really cartoony. They're schlubby and slobs, says Wong. So many of the guys I grew up with in the Bay Area still live at home because they are scared to pay rent and potentially lose getting to do what they want to do in life. For the majority of my friends, the woman is the breadwinner. When Wong socializes, it is mostly with the same 7 women she befriended at UCLA, where she majored in Asian American Studies. Joking about her unlikely success, given her focus, she has said, "Ethnic studies is a major where you study how to blame everything on white people. It's not supposed to yield income. We all had kids at the same time, and they have nothing to do with entertainment," she says proudly. "They're public defenders, lawyers, event organizers, pharmacists, graphic designers. They could give 2 shits about what I do. They never ask me about any of it or for anything." The Saturday after we meet, Wong invited her friends and their kids over to her house to chill and eat food delivered by a Korean catering company. Wong grew up the youngest of 4 children in the Pacific Heights neighborhood of San Francisco. She was not a comedy nerd. She loved Eddie Murphy, but didn't know who Mitch Hedberg was. Sometime around the 6th grade, while attending camp at San Francisco's Cameron House, an organization for Chinese American families, Wong caught her first hit of audience laughter. The memory is still vivid. She was playing a game where one person is told to mime an activity, like washing an elephant. Then, like interactive telephone, The kids were told to attempt to mimic whatever the last person was doing without a clear directive. I didn't know what I was doing, but at one point, I guess, I was washing the elephant's butt, she says. People started laughing, and then I started really milking it, exaggerating. People were like crying on the floor laughing. It was all physical. I wasn't talking or anything, and I was the youngest person in that camp. That was very defining. I just remember it was all instinctual. It was just like feeding off the energy from them. After college, Wong spent time in Vietnam studying language on a Fulbright scholarship. It was such a formative part of my life, she says, adding that it helped her feel more connected to her mother, Tammy, who immigrated to the United States from the country when she was 18. Everyone can tell you that you are a very small part in this world, but you really feel an internalized perspective when you witness this whole society that speaks another language and is operating without any consciousness of your existential crises. Though she had participated in a comedy and theater group in college, it wasn't until Wong returned and moved back in with her parents that she attempted stand-up. I think I was 23, and it was at this place called the Brainwash Cafe. It was very grimy, and it was half cafe, half laundromat, 100% homeless shelter, she recalls. I mean, there were times where it was an open mic, and I'd be doing my 3 minutes, and there were maybe 3 people in the audience. And one of them would just be a homeless guy, and I could see his hand moving underneath his pants. Her early material was mostly one-liners, containing the DNA of what her stand-up would become. A sampling. Last night, I mixed up the KY jelly with the toothpaste and woke up with an extra white butthole. Apart from her talent and voice, what stood out to Rock about Wong was she was concerned. A lot of comedians are so cocky, especially younger ones. But she was just really concerned, and this very pregnant grown-up, it was like a breath of fresh air. When I relay this compliment to Wong, she offers a deadpan response. A lot of that might be that I got the crazy out of the way. She theorizes that what Rock is interpreting as grown-up is actually just her "I'm so grateful that I'm alive" energy. Wong's wild years, which she details in Dear Girls, began in high school and continued through her 20s. When I ask for an example, she politely demurs. She wants people to wait for the book, but allows, "I was definitely a drinker, like 40 ounces of malt liquor." She is so small, she would need both hands to grip a single bottle. I could do probably 2 of those. At the time, I didn't know any better, and I thought it was delicious, or I made myself think it was delicious. And then you grow old. Then you become a responsible adult, and you're like, "Oh, I was drinking pee." For a benchmark of how crazy the crazy period gets, Wong guesses she will let her daughters watch her stand-up specials when they're 13 and read the book when they're 16. Wong's preeminent concern these days is preparing her daughters for flight, which is probably why she wrote Dear Girls. Her other main motivation stems from the 2011 death of her father, Adolphus, a Chinese-American anesthesiologist. "He left me this letter before he passed away, and it was really sweet," Wong says. "It means so much to me, but I wish that there was a lot more. I wish I knew more about what he was like before I was born." It's important for Wong that her daughters know she was once a young person with faults, that took risk, that failed, that struggled. They came into my life after baby Cobra, so they don't know my journey to get where I am, what made me who I am. I may have gone through the same things, especially when they're going through puberty and have all these raging hormones that they do. That's why it's kind of like an advice book. I wanted to do a series of letters to my daughters, she said, of the October release, and I might as well make a bunch of money off it, too. Wong also tackles issues she hasn't been able to easily discuss or conflate into tight stand-up bits in the book. It's very specifically hard for me to talk about my family, I would say, and also my time abroad, she says. And she answers a question she gets a lot these days. What is it like being an Asian American woman in entertainment? She tells me, I hate that question. It bothers me that it's mostly Asian American women who ask it, because I think that there are so many better questions to ask if they're interested in getting into entertainment, but I've kind of come to terms with why it's important. 13 years after those first stand-up sets, Wong could easily sell out the largest rooms of her life, but, she says, she dislikes performing in venues that hold more than 3,500 people. You lose the intimacy with the audience, which is so much what the magic of stand-up comedy is about. To meet demand, Wong has instead multiplied the number of shows she performs in each city, which makes for an easier schedule, given that she will be traveling with her small children, husband, and a nanny, or rotating relative, flown in to help. This way, the family will have time at each tour stop to explore new science centers, natural history museums, and other kid-friendly activities that they've already exhausted in Los Angeles. And at night, after the kids have gone to sleep, Wong can hone her comedy. Wong is not an artist who gets caught up in or distracted by superfluous details, as her simple tour writer attests. Dental floss, Fiji water, Pellegrino, and a box of Kleenex. She recently upgraded her green room, though. Now I bring my own diffuser with light eucalyptus oil, because I heard that Madonna does that. Her occasional splurges are sound. She recently allowed herself a Credit Suisse gold bar on a chain from a jeweler named Tan Huang. It's a very Vietnamese purchase. Gold is where we love to put our money with zero guilt, since it's an investment. And her sense of vanity, for Hollywood at least, is non-existent. Rather than pay a makeup artist to travel with her, she applies her own eyebrow pencil, blush, and eyeliner backstage. That's all, in about 5 minutes. I feel like a clown when I wear lipstick, and mascara just bats up against my glasses, creating streaks, she explains, offering an additional rationale for her minimal makeup. I don't want to do all that work to take it off afterwards. During the past 3 years, as she experimented with on-camera sitcom work and red carpet events, Wong came to an important personal realization that informed the new trajectory of her career. The death of a great female comedic voice is not marriage, not kids. It's the hair and makeup chair, she says with a sigh. I think it's very tempting, because it's really exciting to look beautiful. But that shit takes time, you know what I mean? And it takes away from writing jokes and spending time with my kids. While she enjoyed the collaborative experience of making and producing Always Be My Maybe, the 6-week production marked the most time she had spent away from her children. It was also the longest break she's taken from stand-up. She probably would have attempted hitting Vancouver comedy clubs after the 14-hour days on set, and after putting her kids to bed, had Rock not talked her down. He was like, "It's your movie, and you should be there for every single take," she says. Though acting in other people's projects can feel like a day at the spa, compared with the writing, producing, and performing required of a one-woman act, Wong has mixed emotions about the time away it requires. When I see other actresses who have kids, I ask them, "Please tell me what's the longest you spent away from your kid." And we share, Wong says, and it makes us all feel a lot better, like we're not monsters. I met Lauryn Hill briefly, and all we did was talk about touring with our kids. because I'm looking for tips on how to travel with kids, and I'm looking for guilt relief, you know. As we wind down lunch, I ask if she has any post-crazy period vices. I have to think about that, she tells me, which I interpret as a polite blow-off. 3 weeks later, we catch up on the phone to talk about kids, studying abroad, the food styling, and Always Be My Maybe. And then she reminds me that at lunch, I had asked about her vices. She didn't have the answer then, but she's been thinking about the question. Such deliberation and thoughtfulness in celebrity interviews is rare these days, and a follow-up conversation is even more so. I expect her to reveal a publicist-approved answer. I like porn, she says, catching me off guard, but I only watch it on this old laptop. While I struggle to come up with a follow-up, she explains that she is partial to power dynamic stuff. So if it's a boss and a secretary, or if it's a teacher and a student, but, you know, they're of adult age. It's not entirely out of left field. Wong's act has a bit about role play, where she says she is so exhausted and overwhelmed from her responsibilities as the primary caregiver to her children and financial provider to her family that the sexiest fantasy she can conjure up is one in which she has no responsibility or decision-making power. I could ask how those pressures have magnified since becoming Keanu Reeves Loves Her famous, with her sold-out audiences now expecting her to best her already quotable comedy. But in this moment, I am not thinking about her stand-up. I'm cycling through the hundreds of interviews I've done, actually the thousands of conversations I've had in real life, and realizing that I have never spoken to another woman about this subject. Her candor is unexpected, which is part of her comedy's cathartic appeal and the source of her growing power. But to Ali Wong, and maybe the generation of women listening to her, it's completely natural, and our conversation keeps moving right along. That's a big vice, I guess, she continues, but then, to me, everybody watches porn. Now this by Mark Rotzo. Conran Country, with photographs by Catherine Highland. Sir Terence Conran, the British designer who revolutionized everything from retail shopping to home furnishings, turns to his ultimate challenge, reshaping his pastoral estate for the 21st century. Opening photos, Sir Terence Conran photographed at Barton Court in his favorite chair, the Carosselli. And Barton Court, Conran's 145-acre estate in Kentbury in the United Kingdom. And some of the 19 Conran Blue Bugatti pedal cars that line a corridor at Barton Court. Every morning at Barton Court, his retreat in the English countryside, Sir Terence Conran settles himself into his favorite perch, the Carosselli chair, developed in 1964 by the Finnish designer Urdo Kukkaporo. It is known as the world's most comfortable chair, a space-age-looking specimen in tan leather and white fiberglass, worthy of a starship captain. To make the world's most comfortable chair more comfortable, or at least easier to get in and out of, Conran, who is 87, and for whom comfort has become an issue due to chronic back problems, decided to add an elegant plinth that raises up the Carosselli a couple of inches. Counted among the many examples of Conran's having improved life quality with a decisive and nearly invisible gesture. It's in this hot-rodded lounge chair that Conran designs the way he always has, going back to his days as an upstart textile designer in the early 1950s, with a 2B pencil on paper, preferring a lap desk to a laptop. "I begin drawing with my first cup of coffee and my first cigar," he said one morning not long ago, sitting in the Carosselli. "I feel relaxed then." Conran, however, hasn't built his career on relaxation. When asked about the design award bestowed upon him in Hong Kong last winter, intended to mark his nearly 7 decades in practice, Conran groaned. "I hate the idea of lifetime achievement," he said, "because it sounds like a full stop." So, what has Sir Terence Conran done? Considering his impact on modern design, his mission to popularize good food, his transformation of the retail store experience, and his overall edifying influence on daily life, Conran has been part Charles and Ray Eames and part Martha Stewart, with a dash of the Galloping Gourmet. As a design practitioner, restaurateur, entrepreneur, author, mentor, bon vivant, and global tastemaker, Conran has been a cultural and aesthetic force ever since 1964, when he opened his original Habitat shop in London. The era-defining design and housewares emporium, which, along with such revolutionary phenomena as the Beatles, Mary Quant, Vidal Sassoon, and The Pill, blew the cobwebs off of post-war Britain, grew into a retail chain that some have argued revolutionized shopping as thoroughly as department stores did in the 19th century. That might be a stretch, and yet Habitat and its tonier cousin, the Conran Shop, which Sir Terence founded in 1973, did make thoughtful design accessible to the masses. What's more, he did it decades before Design Within Reach, or Room and Board, or even IKEA, which acquired, then sold, the Habitat chain. Earlier this year, I flew to England to pay Conran a visit. He divides his week between a London apartment and a Richard Rogers-designed glass tower on the south bank of the Thames and Barton Court, the Georgian pile that was a near ruin when he bought it in 1971. Even though Conran has lived there for almost a half century, the 145-acre property is his latest major project, one that, given his age, takes on added meaning and urgency. It's an ambitious overhaul intended to create a thoroughly modern, sustainable estate for the 21st century. As Conran told me, we're trying to make Barton Court economically viable. An admirer of Conran's intimated that the ambitious plan may well be barmy, but that Conran didn't come to be Conran by modest planning or half measures. It was ever thus. After launching his career in textiles, Conran made the bold move of establishing a furniture studio with his mentor, the artist Eduardo Paolozzi. Things just cascaded from there. Over the years, Conran helped introduce London to espresso, pioneered flat-pack furniture, designed Quant's Boutique, an epicenter of 60s London. Quant, in fact, created uniforms for Habitat staff, opened more than 50 restaurants that helped recast British food as something the world no longer snickers at, wrote a raft of books, the house book, the essential garden book, plain, simple, useful, that adorn innumerable coffee tables, and more recently set up the Boundary Project, a complex in East London's booming Shoreditch that combines food, retail, and hospitality. 2.5 years ago, London's Design Museum, which Conran conceived and erected in the 80s, reopened in a new John Pawson design space, its third home. If you were to argue that no other design personality has shaped the way we live now quite as much as Sir Terence Conran, you would not be alone. As Craig Brown, the British satirist and Vanity Fair contributor, put it, before Conran, there were no chairs and no France. The art dealer John Kesmin, a friend of Conran's, once joked, the problem with Terence is that he wants the whole world to have a better salad bowl. The hotelier and Studio 54 impresario Ian Schrager compared Conran's cultural influence to Andy Warhol's. He's made design fun and accessible. Is he a designer or a businessman? Has been the perennial question. In 2019, it seems irrelevant. Conran has always approached design as a business proposition and business as a design problem. There's no point in making and curating good products without devising the means to bring them to the general population. Even so, Conran, with his reputation as a perfectionist and a hard-ass, has had his share of dust-ups and detractors. Ambitious, mean, kind, greedy, frustrated, emotional, tiresome, intolerant, shy, fat, those descriptors are courtesy of Conran himself. Sir Roy Strong, the former director of the Victoria and Albert Museum, has made him out to be a bullying egomaniac with one good idea, Habitat. He's a really absurd fellow, Conran cracks back. The Design Museum's first director, Stephen Bailey, a perpetual sparring partner, has called Conran a self-mythologizing bastard. The track record, however, suggests there is much worth mythologizing. He is the most passionate man in Britain when it comes to design, and his central idea has always been design is there to improve your life, the British designer Edward Barber told me. Thomas Heathwick, the UK designer, Thomas Heatherwick, the UK designer who created the hive-like multi-tiered vessel in Manhattan's Hudson Yards, said he considered Conran one of the handful of visionaries who moved Britain forward to make it an influence around the world. Ruth Rogers, the American-born chef and restaurateur who co-founded London's River Cafe, said, I have an allergy towards the word legend. Everyone is a legend these days. But if you want to say legend, well, Terence is that. At a dinner celebrating the legend's 80th birthday, a guest asked Conran if he had any resolutions or goals left to fulfill. Conran didn't hesitate. "To stop effing around and do more," he said. Next, photos. The kitchen at Barton Court. One of the gardens. Two items from Conran's collection of Michelin Man memorabilia. The front of the house. The gardens as seen from the roof. The entryway situated at the back of the manor. Gazebo, a thesis project sculpture designed by Thomas Heatherwick and acquired by Conran. The River Kennet, which meanders through the grounds of the estate. On a wintry London afternoon, Conran invited me along to his flagship Conran shop, which occupies the circa 1911 landmark known as the Michelin House, a structure he first admired 55 years ago when he opened the original habitat directly across Sloane Avenue in Chelsea. It is a fanciful bauble of a building, sheathed in playful decorative tiles and stained glass windows depicting the Michelin Man, otherwise known as Bibendum, in sporting poses. Like the French tire company's mascot, Conran is mischievous, portly, highly recognizable, and seemingly indestructible. He has encountered nails and broken glass in his path. Mergers and sell-offs, and occasional lawsuits, tabloid sniping and professional rivalries and family feuds, and has kept bouncing along. "I love this building so much," Conran said, casting his blue eyes around the showroom. "I put so much time into it." He lowered himself onto a Conran couch, his clasped hands resting atop the handle of his cane. Conran was dressed in customary shades of blue, blue flannel sport coat, blue cashmere polo shirt, blue cords, and blue suede Todd's driving mocks, all offset by burgundy socks. Shoppers buzzed around the showroom amid the Eames shell chairs, Castiglione floor lamps, and Terence Conran designed this and that, while the white-haired Pyhandrum watched them circulating. I sat down next to Conran and saw one customer after another do double takes upon seeing the man himself at the center of a universe he created. He bought Michelin House with the late publisher Paul Hamlin in 1985, when, according to Conran, it was a shambles. The two men founded the Conran Octopus imprint, which has published many of Conran's books, and the Hamlin family remains co-owner of the property. After a $15 million restoration, Michelin House reopened in 1987, hosting the Conran shop as well as Bibendum, a French brasserie that, along with such Conran establishments as Coiglino's and Bluebird, spearheaded London's restaurant renaissance. 32 years later, the store is still humming, and Bibendum is still considered one of the town's best dining spots. Appropriately enough, under the guidance of French-born chef Claude Bozzi, it was awarded 2 stars in the 2018 Michelin Guide. That sense of buzz extended to the staff as well. At one point, a starstruck clerk answered Conran's questions about the enormous moon pendant light by the Italian designer David Groppi. It retails for $4,200. The Conran shop's energetic CEO, Hugh Walla, with round Philip Johnson spectacles, came over to chat. "He totally democratized design," Walla said of Conran, telling how, in his undergrad days, Walla would visit the Conran shop every Saturday, which set him on his career path. Jonathan Ive, the visionary designer of Apple's product line, was likewise galvanized by visiting Habitat in his youth. Heatherwick and Barber tell similar stories. When Conrad and I moved over to Bibendum's mosaic-tiled oyster bar, an exuberant Chef Bosie swung by to check on Conrad's bivalves and smoked salmon, both excellent. The effusive reception at Michelin House did nothing to cloud Conrad's exacting vision. Back downstairs in the showroom, Conrad summoned Walla over. "You have a problem with your staff," he proclaimed. Walla looked vaguely doomstruck, but game to weather whatever blow the master was about to deliver. In his younger days, the sticklerish Conrad was notorious for upbraiding employees who put insufficiently used paper in their waste baskets. Now, Conrad pointed out that a gaggle of staffers had congregated behind a pillar while shoppers roamed unattended. He wanted the clerks out there on the floor, offering help, making sales. The man who once lorded over combined retail concerns that generated $2.3 billion annually was essentially directing his CEO to adopt the role of hawkish floor manager. Walla went off to stir up the troops. When Conran isn't making his rounds in London, he can be found in his caroselli chair in a sun-drenched study off the kitchen at Barton Court, near the tiny Berkshire village of Kentbury. "It's a bit of a junk heap in here," Conrad said by way of welcome. That may have been vaguely true, but the comfort, harmony, and visual interest on display were a refutation of everything Marie Kondo stands for. On a windsill rest various medals, including the British Companion of Honor, which Conran, along with Paul McCartney and J.K. Rowling, received from the Queen in 2017. Past honorees include Winston Churchill, Stephen Hawking, and David Hockney, who in the early 70s designed the menu for Conran's Neal Street restaurant. Arrayed next to the medals are four metal numerals that were once affixed to Barton Court to denote the year of its construction. They spell out 1727, which might be an accidental reordering of the year most commonly given, 1772. Other sources say 1680. There's a nifty model airplane in one corner and a lavender-blue coffee table of Conran's own design, whose asymmetry was inspired by an antique ashtray from Burr, the French aperitif company. The room is dominated by a hanging paper Ingo Maurer lamp, whose bimorphic shape is reminiscent of the shredded remains of a cocoon or chrysalis. For much of his life, Conran was an avid collector of butterflies and moths, a hobby begun during his war years, boyhood in Hampshire. He grew up nouveau poor, his father an importer of gum copal, a substance used to make paint and varnish. His mother, Conrad said, would have been a designer had women been trained for that before the war. "She had much to do with my education, choosing Bryanston, an English public school with an arty bent, after I had been at a school uninterested in visual matters." Conran's younger sister Priscilla also pursued a design career and has held important positions in the Conran Empire. At age 12 or 13, Conran suffered a burst appendix, which forced him to stay home for 6 months. "It was then that I got my workshop going," he said, elaborating that his mother encouraged him to build things, dollhouse furniture and the like. It was while he was working on one such project that a metal splinter shot off a lathe, embedding itself in Conran's left eye and impairing his vision for life. After Bryanston came the Central School of Art and Design in London, which Conran left in 1949, only to emerge into a post-war England that was all spam sandwiches, clunky furniture, and doilies. When he was 21, a sojourn to France, including a Paris dishwashing stint in the kitchens of La Méditerranée, made Conran wonder why life in Britain couldn't be as colorful, stylish, generous, and well-designed as what he found on the continent. By 1953, he'd opened his first restaurant, Soup Kitchen, near Charing Cross. Here, Conran paused in his reminiscence and turned his attention back to the butterfly and moth specimens lining the study shelves. "It's evil to collect them now," he said, noting that he gave up the practice in light of plunging lepidopteran populations. One thing Conran has refused to give up is his cigar. He cut and lit a Hoya de Monterey and explained that the results of his ritual morning sketches sometimes go into production at the Conran shop, or at one of the many firms that hire Conran, or at Benchmark, the bespoke furniture company he founded in 1984 with Sean Sutcliffe. The Benchmark workshops occupy a cluster of outbuildings just steps away from Conran's study. There, amid the planers and sawdust, 46 craftsmen create custom-built pieces for private clients and for such redoubtable institutions as 10 Downing Street, Westminster Abbey, and even Hogwarts. For an octogenarian, Conran has plenty on his lap desk. He talked about ramping up the current exhibition, Swinging London, a Lifestyle Revolution, at London's Fashion and Textile Museum, celebrating him and Mary Quant. It's on through June 2nd. He mentioned the prospect of reintroducing his 60s-era cone chair, which looks like an outsize, inverted Asian rice hat propped on three spindly metal legs. Conran and Partners, the architectural firm he founded in 1989, has a full slate of projects concentrating on social housing. Later this year, a new Conran shop will open in Seoul. It will be the 10th such store currently in operation. Conran has had mixed success stateside. While he began his U.S. retail presence at Macy's in 1968 and opened his first Conran's, an American version of Habitat, in Manhattan's Citicorp Tower in 1977, today all of the Conran's outlets have been shuttered, supplanted by legions of design shops that are, in effect, the offspring of Conran. What most excites Conran these days is an inward-looking endeavor, reimagining Barton Court and ensuring its future, one to be overseen by the Conran family. "This place was in such a state," he recalled of his first visit in 1971. "The roof had caved in. There was mold everywhere." For centuries, Barton Court had been the seat of the Dundas family, admirals and such. When Conran bought it, the house had most recently been a boys' school called Purton Stoke. "And because it had been a school," Conran said, "someone said to me, 'Why do you want this house? It's still got the smell of smacked bottoms.' I don't know if we've removed the smell entirely. It's up to you to judge." The smell is long gone. In its place are sunny hallways and rooms, 27 in all, painted bright white and filled with art by Hockney and Richard Smith. A collection of 19 pedal car Bugattis hangs along one wall, every vehicle painted Conran blue, a rich cobalt. The south-facing living room, running the length of the building, was created by knocking out walls, a Conran design signature that dates to the Regent's Park townhouse he shared in the 1950s with his second wife, the best-selling author Shirley Conran, Superwoman, Lace. Throughout Barton Court, there's that Conranian mix of modern, a profusion of Vico Magistrati Eclisse lamps, and vintage, a life-size wooden horse used for saddle-making. In the renovated kitchen, where Conran's wife, number four, Vicky, prepared a fortifying lunch of ossobuco ragu with pappardelle and free-flowing chateaumeuf du pape, a battery of copper pots reminiscent of those in the kitchen department at the original habitat, hangs over the aga. The grounds of Barton Court drift down to the stream-like glinting River Kennet. The focal point is a thoroughly modern folly, a towering pavilion-like bench done in stacked plywood that rises in a sweeping double helix. Its name is Gazebo, and it was Heatherwick's student thesis project, which Conran invited the young designer to complete at Barton Court. "He ended up buying that from me," Heatherwick said, "and that's how I started my studio." Several years ago, the product designer Sir James Dyson, as in vacuums and hand dryers, landed a helicopter a bit too close to Gazebo, damaging the structure. The Conrans and Heatherwick laugh about it. Another afternoon, Shay Conran. Conran's goal is to transform the place into a self-sufficient entity. "Most estates have to rely on EU subsidies," he said. "Most of those won't be available in the future." British country houses are notoriously difficult to keep up. The trick, Conran explained, is for Barton Court to provide revenue beyond the lucrative Benchmark furniture operation. In 2017, he bought an additional 120 acres, opening further access to the Kennet. He has hired a riverkeeper who has been narrowing the channel and reforming the banks. The plan is to attract the trout fishing crowd, who would pay a nominal fee to spend the day casting in the Kennet, which at one time was renowned for its fishing. While much of the surrounding acreage had been ravaged by gravel extraction, that land has been revived and hundreds of trees have been planted. Sheep graze in pasturage, and other animals may soon arrive to generate income from sustainable husbandry. For decades, the massive walled garden and greenhouses have been used for growing fruits and vegetables. Conran aims to amp up cultivation and sell the goods to restaurants. Barton Court supplies produce to Bibendum's kitchen. "That garden was our playground," said Sophie Conran, the daughter of Terence and his third wife, the food writer Caroline Conran. The couple divorced in 1996 after 33 years of marriage, with a headline-generating settlement in the area of $18 million. In the 70s, the culinary landscape was bleak in the UK, and they, her parents, were growing all these exotic things that we don't consider exotic anymore, such as tomatoes that didn't taste like cardboard, years before anyone thought of calling them heirloom. Sophie, a director of the Conran shop and a successful name-brand designer herself, recalled that to be a kid at Barton Court was to be surrounded by a virtual salon of artists from every walk of life. She remembered the day Francis Bacon visited, got very drunk, and ate what she estimated to be an entire pound of cheddar cheese. The artist handed her brother Tom a 50-pound note, thinking he was a waiter. By his own admission, Conran wasn't the most attentive father, but Sophie told me that the Barton Court patriarch was unfailingly enthusiastic and excited and engaged. He brought that into our lives. The Conrans, for half a century now, have been a dynasty whose every move plays out in the pages of England's tabloids and glossies. Sophie's older half-brothers, by Shirley, are product designer Sebastian Conran and fashion designer Jasper Conran, stars themselves. Jasper had a brief reign as chairman of Conran Holdings, resigning in 2015 after his father complained in an interview about not being consulted enough. Jasper once said, "In our family, you don't so much swim as drown." Yet recent Instagram posts show the two of them, and pretty much the entire family, being chummy. The ups and downs, divorces, silent treatments, perceived slights, are perhaps to be expected with a complex modern clan living under a media microscope. The biggest moment of family anguish came when Ned, the youngest Conran's son and Sophie's younger brother, was found guilty of indecent assault in 2001, the culmination of a struggle with mental health and substance issues. He has long since re-emerged and, like his older brother Tom, is a successful restaurateur. Conran spoke with buoyant pride of the many accomplishments of his offspring. He noted that he is now a great-grandfather, and that even some of his 13 grandchildren, plus one from Vicky's side, are carrying on the family tradition. Sophie's daughter, Coco Conran, for instance, unveiled her first fashion collection in March, and her son, Felix Conran, is becoming established as a product designer. It all sort of rubbed off, the elder Conran said. Next photo, Conran and wife Vicky in the lounge. For a man who lives like a peer on a country estate, one recent estimate placed his personal fortune at $113 million, Conran's lifelong quest has been to demonstrate that it isn't just the posh who can have good taste. This was embedded in Habitat's mission, given Conran's passion for humble, well-constructed utilitarian goods. Kitchen towels, Brown Betty teapots, the clay chicken brick casserole that Habitat turned into a British institution. Conran has historically been a labor man and once called Margaret Thatcher one of the most odious people who's ever walked the face of the earth. As Heatherwick put it, his socialist passion is something that runs deep. Business follows belief for him. Brexit makes Conran positively apoplectic. Earlier this year, he was a high-profile signatory, along with other UK business leaders, of a public letter in the Times urging a second referendum. It's easy to see why he despises the idea of a divorce from Europe. When it comes to design and living and eating, Conran has been a Matthew Arnold of our day, a moral conscience and avowed multiculturalist, looking to the continent and beyond for inspiration and sustenance while providing Britain with a steady Arnoldian stream of the best that is known and thought in the world. Conran, in essence, helped introduce Britons to the concept of modernity. It was all about trying to strip out the constraints of how people were living, Sophie Conran told me, and giving them freedom and choice and light and expansion. While Conran is viewed as one of the godfathers of lifestyle, it's a concept he loathes. In his view, when one's avocado toast, perfect Negroni, or bench-made shoes become humble brag Instagram fodder, the culture has lapsed into a state of all sensibility and no sense. Lifestyleification has extended to design itself, in which the smallest detail is fetishized. There are design shops everywhere, to the point where it's almost gone crazy, Heatherwick said. Useful, everyday design, a concept synonymous with Conran, has gone a bit comedy. For his part, Conran calls wasteful consumerism a contemporary evil. It was not what he had in mind in 1964, when various Beatles trooped into Habitat to buy Dieter Rams hi-fi equipment, or when novelist Kingsley Amis and Elizabeth Jane Howard flirted among the garlic presses and woks. Two more items Conran popularized. Other current design trends alarm him. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A, airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.